The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the February, March, April issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to go right to Who's Who in Sports, and we're going to start in the first line. We have Joe Burrow, quarterback, LSU. His height is 6'4". His weight is 216 pounds. He was born December 10th, 1996 in Ames, Iowa. In his second season at LSU starting quarterback, Burrow broke the school record for passing yards in a season and became the fourth SEC quarterback to throw for 4,000 yards. On November 9, 2019, Burrow led the second-ranked Tigers past number 3 Alabama 46-41. He threw for 393 yards and 3 touchdowns. At Athens, Ohio High, he led his team to 7 playoff wins, the first in school history. He spent 3 years at Ohio State before transferring to LSU. Question: which 3 schools have produced the most Heisman Trophy winners? Boop. Answer: Notre Dame, Ohio State, and Oklahoma, with 7 each. Next, we have Sabrina Ionescu. She's a guard from Oregon. Her height is 5'11". She was born December 6, 1997, in Walnut Creek, California. Ionescu is the NCAA career leader in triple doubles. Through December 1st, she had 19. The next closest player, Kyle Collingsworth of BYU, had 12. As a junior, Ionescu averaged 19.9 points per game, 7.4 rebounds, and 8.2 assists per game, and led the Ducks to the 2019 Final Four. The daughter of immigrants from Romania, Ionescu was the consensus high school player of the year for Marymount High in Orinda, California. Question: what is the capital of Romania? Answer: Bucharest. And finally, we have Kumar Rocker, pitcher from Vanderbilt. His height is 6'4". His weight is 255 pounds. He was born November 2nd, 1999, in Montgomery, Alabama. As a freshman, Rocker was named Most Outstanding Player at the 2019 College World Series. He was 2-0 with a 1.46 ERA in the College World Series as the Commodores won their second title. Facing elimination in the Super Regionals against Duke, Rocker threw a no-hitter in which he struck out 19 Blue Devils. It was the first no-hitter in Super Regionals history. Rocker's father, Tracy, was a football star at Auburn and now is the defensive line coach at Vandy's arch rival, Tennessee. In which sport did Vanderbilt win its first national title in 2007? Answer: women's bowling. History. Most fans know that Jackie Robinson broke Major League Baseball's color line, but that was just one of many feats in the remarkable career of this trailblazer. Title: A Groundbreaking Life. UCLA. Jackie Robinson made history in 1947 when he became the first African American to play in the majors since the 1880s. But anyone who saw him when he was a student at UCLA a few years earlier would have been shocked that baseball was the sport in which Robinson became a legend. Robinson was a four-sport star at Pasadena Junior College for 2 years. In 1939, he enrolled at UCLA. He became the first and still only Bruins athlete to letter in four sports. On the football field, he twice led the nation in punt returns and was the team leading rusher and passer in 1940. One of his teammates, Kenny Washington, broke the NFL's color barrier in 1946. On the basketball court, Robinson led the Southern Division of the Pacific Coast Conference in scoring in each of his two seasons. He was also a member of the track team, winning the NCAA championship in the long jump. Had the 1940 and 1944 Olympics not been canceled due to World War II, he most likely would have competed for the United States. On the diamond, though, it was a different story. Robinson got off to a fantastic start, getting four hits and stealing four bases in his first game. But he finished his only season with the Bruins with a meager 90.97 batting average. It was a far cry from the Hall of Fame stroke he would display in the majors. Despite his struggles with the Bruins, UCL named its baseball field Jackie Robinson Stadium in 1981. Happy returns. Robinson averaged 8.8 yards per punt return in his UCLA career, which is the sixth best in NCAA history. Good job, number 28. United States Army. In April 1942, 4 months after the outbreak of World War II, Robinson was inducted into the United States Army. At the time, the military was largely racially segregated, and Robinson felt that prejudice in various ways. Competition between forts in a variety of sports was fierce. Robinson was better known for his football prowess than baseball. So when he attempted to join his fort's baseball team, he was told he had to play for the Negro team, which didn't exist. And though Robinson went through officer candidate school and attained the rank of second lieutenant, he was ultimately sent to an all-black tank battalion based in Texas. The most extreme incident came on July 6, 1944. Robinson boarded an Army bus that was supposed to be desegregated. Still, the driver ordered Robinson to the back. He refused, and when the bus reached the end of the line, the driver called the military police. Investigators recommended that Robinson be court-martialed, which required his commanding officer's consent. When the officer refused to allow the charges, Robinson was transferred to another unit, one whose commander would okay the court-martial. Robinson was ultimately charged with insubordination. At his trial, he was found not guilty. Robinson served out his time in the Army in Kentucky. While there, he met a fellow soldier who had played with the Kansas City Monarchs of the Negro Leagues. He recommended Robinson to the team, setting in motion the events that would culminate with Robinson's breaking the color barrier in 1947. It wasn't until a year later that racial discrimination was officially banned in the United States Armed Forces. Montreal Royals. Robinson signed with the Dodgers organization in 1945. In October, after spending one season in the Negro Leagues, but Dodgers president Branch Rickey wanted to ease his transition to the majors, so Rickey decided that Robinson would spend the 1946 season with the Montreal Royals of the AAA International League. Robinson was largely welcomed in Canada. He and his wife Rachel lived below a family with eight French-speaking children. When Rachel was pregnant, the kids would always carry her groceries for her. And Robinson gave fans plenty of reason to cheer on the field. He led the league in batting average, .349, and runs scored as the Royals put up a record 100-54. That was good enough to earn them a spot in the Junior World Series against the champions of the AAA American Association, the Louisville Colonels. When the series began in Kentucky, Robinson wasn't allowed to stay in the team hotel, which was for whites only. The Royals considered not playing, but the series went on. Robinson got off to a slow start in the first three games in Louisville, but he led the Royals to three straight wins to clinch the series. After the final game, he was mobbed by ecstatic fans who hugged him and tore at his clothes. I will always feel a deep sense of gratitude and appreciation for the attitude of the people in Montreal, Rachel told Smithsonian Magazine in 2015. It had a lot to do with our future success. Family man. After leaning on his wife to fight prejudice, Robinson became so beloved that he was welcomed on the enormously popular Ed Sullivan Show after he retired. Family. Robinson was handpicked by Branch Rickey to break the color barrier. Rickey wanted a player who could handle the pressure and hatred and had plenty of support. For Robinson, that was a fellow UCLA student named Rachel Isom. They married in 1946, a year before Robinson's major league debut, after a five-year courtship. "When they try to destroy me, it's Rachel who keeps me sane," Robinson said. They would have three children, and Rachel went on to become a nurse and then a professor. Legacy. Robinson retired from the majors in 1957. 47 years after his death, he remains one of the most popular players in history. The Rookie of the Year award is named for him, and the number 42 was retired league-wide in his honor. Every April 15th, the anniversary of his first game, all major leaguers wear 42 on their jerseys. "50 years ago, one kicker forever changed how football was played. And who played it? We imagine America's favorite sport if we had never laced up. What if? Imagine you're watching Patrick Mahomes try to lead a fourth quarter comeback. Awesome. Down by just 2 points. His coach tells him to go for it on fourth down on the opponent's 30 with 5 seconds left on the clock. Why wouldn't they kick a field goal? Mahomes is wearing an oiless powder blue jersey. Huh? His fans in Houston are going nuts. What? If he makes his final throw, they might finally beat Anaheim for the AFL championship. Wait, who? Huh? As confusing as that scenario is, it might have been our reality if a Hungarian soccer player named Pete Gogolak had not yet joined Cornell University's football team in the fall of 1961. Really? I can explain. Let's start with our fictional Oilers' decision to go for it. Kicking used to be as much less certain proposition than it is now. Last season, NFL kickers made 84.7% of all field goals. They attempted 152 from at least 50 yards, of which they hit 97. The season before Gogolak went pro, 1963, teams made less than half their field goals. They only tried 6 kicks from beyond 50 yards. Gogolak changed the game. A former soccer player, he kicked the football the way modern players do, approaching the ball at an angle and driving it through with the top of their foot. In the early 60s, convention held that kickers ran straight at the ball, kept their kicking leg straight, and poked the pigskin with their toe. If you've ever played soccer, your coach has undoubtedly told you that kicking with your toe is a good way to lose power and control. Gogolak's results were undeniable. He made 54 of 55 extra points for Cornell, including a record 44 in a row. He also booted the first 50-yard field goal in college football history. Still, traditionalists spurned Gogolak's style. Undrafted by the NFL, the Buffalo Bills of the upstart American Football League took a flyer on him in the 1964 AFL draft. It was a good move. Gogolak kicked the league-leading 28 field goals in 1965 and converted all of his extra points. That production got noticed by the NFL's New York Giants. Their kicker in 1965, Bob Timberlake, had missed 14 of his 15 tries. They spent $32,000 per year to lure Gogolak away from the Bills and in the process started a war. The NFL and the AFL did not like each other, but they had a gentleman's agreement not to poach each other's players. This created more competition for unsigned rookies, but generally kept an uneasy peace. The Gogolak signing violated that truth. In retaliation, the AFL hired a new commissioner, one they could count on to take no prisoners, Raiders coach and general manager Al Davis. Davis hit the NFL where it hurt, credibly threatening to sign 7 of their star quarterbacks to 7 AFL teams. The NFL waved the white flag, and soon after, in 1966, the AFL and the NFL merged into the modern NFL. So back to our fictional present in which Gogolak had stuck to soccer. The leagues merged eventually, but not until the AFL had pressured its rival with aggressive expansion that was otherwise scrapped in 1966. Anaheim gets a team, and the Eagles warily greet a cross-town rival in Philadelphia. The Hawks? lacking the money they would have earned in the merger, the Steelers stay a perennial basement dweller, and the steel curtain never falls on the AFC, allowing the Oilers to become a power. With a gentleman's agreement on veteran contracts intact, the race for rookies heats up, with the AFL creating a development league meant to circumvent the NCAA. College football, as we know it today, never materializes. The Super Bowl starts in 1980 and is just another championship game. And instead of watching soccer-style field goal kicks every Sunday, America prefers to watch, well, soccer. Renaissance athletes, unicorns. These players do it all. Skills have expanded our ideas of what's possible at their positions. Pitcher Zach Greinke is unusually good at hitting. Ask about his emotions before starting Game 7 of the 2019 World Series. Astros pitcher Zach Greinke gave an amusingly understated answer. I'm a little excited about it at the moment, but we'll see. Before adding, I wish he was in the National League Park. It's no wonder he'd rather have played on the road than he could have hit for himself. The 35-year-old, who had played most of the season in Arizona before being traded to the American League, slashed 280, 308, 580 with 3 home runs, 1 triple, and 2 doubles in 56 plate appearances last season. He won the Silver Slugger and Gold Glove Award at pitcher. Number 7. Pitchers to ever record a stolen base, a triple, a two-bagger, and a home run in a season, including Greinke. Defenseman Chris Letang is money in the shootout. Chris Letang leads all blue liners with 24 shootout goals since the format was introduced in 2005. It's no wonder why. The Penguins coaches have entrusted him with 66 career attempts, 15 more than the next highest defenseman. He loves the flashy enclosed dekes that leave goalies helpless. He usually follows Evgeny Malkin and Sidney Crosby in the Penguins shootout order. That's a pretty good lineup in which to bat third. 36.4% conversion rate on shootout attempts. Center Nikola Jokic is weirdly good at passing. He passes like a point guard and looks like not a point guard. He's been known to dribble and dish behind his massive back. Only 2 centers have ever averaged more than 6 assists per game in a season. Will Chamberlain, who did it twice, and Jokic, who was on pace for his 3rd such season. Even in this era of do-it-all big men, teams typically don't run their offenses through a 7-footer. What other center has YouTube highlight reels just for his passing? Punter Johnny Hecker knows how to chuck it. Hecker was a 2-star quarterback coming out of Bothell Washington High School, something all opposing special teams coaches should know by now. Hecker is a master of the fake punt, going 12 for 21 with 179 yards, 1 touchdown, and 1 interception as an NFL passer. He finished his rookie season with a perfect 158.3 passer rating on 3 attempts. And should the Rams ever find themselves in serious injury trouble, Hecker is the team's emergency quarterback. 14.9 average yards per completion. Guard Russell Westbrook is a rebounding whiz. The king of the triple-double, Westbrook holds the single-season record 42 and his career total 140, ranked 2nd. By far the most impressive of the 3 stat categories he dominates is rebounds. He and Oscar Robertson, the guy ahead of him on the all-time triple-double leaderboard, each have 3 of the 6 all-time best rebounding seasons by a point guard. And unlike the 6'5" Robertson or 6'9" Magic Johnson, another point guard who has a triple-double machine, Westbrook stands just 6'3". 110 rebounds between him and the next best point guard last season. He is 15 years old. He slips out of his bi-level house in Ypsilanti, Michigan, subdivision in the morning darkness, wearing a hoodie and holding a fork and a plate of waffles and eggs. just a teenager who snagged a few extra minutes of sleep. He climbs into the passenger seat of his father's Ford Expedition because he isn't old enough to drive himself to school yet. It's another mundane day in the life of a sophomore high school basketball player, except this one has a goal: to try to be the best player ever. Magic, Michael, LeBron, Imani? Well, kids are supposed to dream, but don't hold it against him. But one assistant at a college superpower, when asked about Imani Bates, says simply, "He is the best player I've ever seen." You have to see it to believe it. A college head coach laughs and agrees. In basketball, every great player evokes memories of another. Imani is 6'9", with long arms, minimalist biceps, and a shooting stroke that's purer than a country sunset. So people inevitably compare him with Kevin Durant. This sounds crazy. It is not crazy. An NBA scouting director calls the Durant analogy obvious. The shooting is remarkable. He has a chance to be really special. One coach who recruited KD calls Imani the same level shooter, but a much better ball handler than Durant at that age. Numbers game. Imani asks his dad to look up LeBron James' stats as a high school freshman, 18 points per game, 6.2 rebounds, and then vowed to beat them, which he did, averaging 28.6 and 10.1 rebounds. Imani noticed last year that no matter where he went in Ypsilanti, heads turned. By the end of his freshman season at Lincoln High, the school gym was overflowing for games. And that was before he hit two buzzer beaters in postseason games and led the team to the Division I state championship. Hundreds of fans were sitting on the floor. The hottest ticket in town had caused a fire hazard. This year, Lincoln will play at least five games in the 8,800-seat arena at nearby Eastern Michigan. It's all too much, too soon, but what if it isn't? What if he is the rare teenager who knows what he wants and knows he can handle it? Imani Bates has a chance to be a generational player for reasons beyond his skill or athleticism. Several people in the sport use two words when describing him: Kobe mentality. Imani has always had that. When he was five, he participated in the layup lines at Pro-Am game. After tip-off, little Imani was mad he wasn't allowed to play. He is quiet around strangers, goofy with friends, and an assassin with a ball in his hands. At one recent workout, his first after taking 2 weeks off on his father's EJ's orders, he made more threes than he missed, but he was still disappointed. He finished by making at least 30 straight high school threes. Then he sat down next to a visitor and said he was sorry he didn't have a better day. Put him on any Division I college team and he could start, and yet he has only 5 scholarship offers. Most big schools aren't recruiting him because they assume that by 2022, the NBA collective bargaining agreement will allow high schoolers to enter the league, and Imani will leave Lincoln to be the number one pick. One NBA front office rep says that on Imani's best day, he could hold his own at an NBA practice right now. It's nuts. The Durant comparison is very realistic, but there are days when he looks 15, which of course he is. Imani puts his plate on the floor of the expedition's back seat, gets out of the car, and walks to class. First period, math. Math has always been Imani's favorite class. He likes it because the subject comes naturally to him, and he has had great teachers who made it fun. Anyway, this can't be bad. Sports are a numbers-driven enterprise. A year ago, before he had played a high school game, Imani sat on his couch and asked his father for LeBron James stats as freshman. EJ looked him up. 18 points and 6.2 rebounds and 3.6 assists per game at St. Vincent Mary in Akron, Ohio. Imani vowed to do better. Then he averaged 28.6 points, 10.1 rebounds, and 1.9 assists. Those numbers don't mean he is better than LeBron, but the story tells you something about the kid. He has studied the King James Bible, but does not take it as gospel. He has talked to James. He has connected with Durant on Instagram. He says getting to know the biggest basketball stars in the world feels normal. Second period, Spanish. Basketball was invented in the United States, and most of the best players in history were born here. But the modern game was shaped by 2 weeks in Spain. The host country's team did not make the medal round. They lost 122-81 to the Americans. They also lost to Angola. But when the United States team sprinkled its genius on those Olympics, the rest of the world watched, learned, and vowed to catch up. Nobody soaked up the lessons faster than Spain, which is now the reigning world champion. What does this teach us about Imani Bates? Take notes, kids. There was a widely held belief in 1992 that if Europeans wanted to make the NBA, they would have to adjust to a more physical game. Well, what happened was the opposite. Americans adopted the European style. Traditional back-to-the-basket centers are an endangered species. Even the tallest players are supposed to have three-point range. Imani Bates is unlike previous stars because he grew up in this era. For 100 years, tall players learned the game from the inside out. Post moves first, followed by mid-range shots, then attempt from farther if they could handle it. Bates learned from the outside in. When he was in second grade, he was a head taller than his classmates, and he was already draining threes. He was crossing opponent over at 8. Coaches talk about positionless basketball. Bates has never had a position. He dribbles, he passes, he scores from anywhere on the floor. He always has. Fifth period, art. Basketball at the highest level is not just a game. It's a form of self-expression. Personalities are revealed through creative passes, ferocious drives, or fear of the big shot. Michael Jordan wanted to rule the world. LeBron James wants his buddies involved, but he wants to be in control. Tim Duncan played like Tim Duncan. Thanks to modern technology, Imani Bates can easily study basketball art history. He admires elements from each of the greats. Kobe, relentless. Durant, scoring machine. Steph Curry, using screens. For all the Durant comparisons, Bates often resembles a 6'9" Curry. Exceptional deep range, super quick dribble. He is learning a sky hook, which not even slow centers use anymore. When he lifts his right knee, reaches up, and drops the ball in the bucket, he looks as if he has watched Kareem Abdul-Jabbar his whole life. Imani's two favorite parts of basketball are scoring and scoring a lot. He did a 360 dunk recently, and he is working on a windmill, but most of his jams are angry. He lives to bury threes in defenders' faces. He says he's not. He does not love playing defense, but he is so long, athletic, and competitive that he will probably become great at it. His goal this year is to be a better teammate. Enjoy the show. If Solani, it won't be yours for long. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I am John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast or at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Talk about you and all the wonderful things that you and I can do. Apart from fashion.